I hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on the wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and fought and died to be. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a fought and died key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a fought and died key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of course all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, there's a lot of stuff about Islamophobia. I'm going to read something here by Robert Spencer, and he writes for Jihad Watch. He says, what happens when an ordinary American stands up to the global jihad? Canada is now, and I'll be talking about this in a few minutes, Canada is now discussing criminal penalties for Islamophobia. Facebook's vice president went to Pakistan in July to assure the Pakistani government that Facebook would remove content critical of Islam. American columnists seriously called for the denial of free speech rights to those who warn about the jihad threat. That call was directed at me, that's Robert Spencer, for the crime of falsely constructing a divide between Islam and the West. Falsely? Really? Clearly, there are some very powerful people who are desperately afraid of what they call Islamophobia, and are now cracking down on it hard. For years, I've been sounding an alarm about the threat of jihad terror and the human rights abuses that Sharia enables. And increasingly, the West, instead of heeding these warnings, is turning against those who've been sounding them. In my forthcoming book, Confessions of an Islamophobe, I make my case. Is there really a threat to the world from jihad and Sharia oppression? Or is such concern all just paranoid, fear-mongering, xenophobia, racism, bigotry, paranoia, profiteering? In a word, Islamophobia. I've always found such accusations bewildering and baseless, and still do. I began this work because I was an ordinary American, a believer in the freedom of speech and free society and equality of rights all before the law. who saw problems that weren't being addressed adequately. In the intervening years, these problems have only gotten worse, and although the ruling elites still generally do not admit that there are any problems at all. So, are they right or am I? You be the judge. In Confessions of an Islamophobe, I discuss the real threat, women, Christians, secular liberals, and secular Muslims face, and reveal what happens to those ordinary citizens who dare to tell the truth about the threat. And this is, it's a book, and you can you can subscribe or purchase it online. Confessions of an Islamophobe. Now, up here in Canada, we've had a hearings this past week for the Heritage Committee of the House of Commons on a motion called M103, or Motion 103, that was brought in by a woman named Ikra Khalid. She's a Liberal Member of Parliament, Pakistani, who has some radical Muslims in her family. Anyway, she brought forth this motion amidst great controversy earlier this year. And the motion calls upon the government to report back within 8 months as to measures that should be taken to combat Islamophobia. Now, I'm always very leery of government trying to combat people's ideas or opinions. To say nothing of the fact that Islamophobia is extremely vague. Literally, fear of Islam or of Muslims. I think considering that most of the terror activities in the around the world in the past 15 years or so have been conducted by people operating in the name of Islam, in the name of that people have reasonable people have every justification to be just a little bit fearful of it, of them, you know. This is this appears on Jihad Watch, but it's largely an article by a frequent writer in Post, and that's Anthony Fury. When Motion 103 condemning Islamophobia was first being discussed, its proponents allayed fears about infringement upon freedom of speech by saying it was just a condemnation, did not have criminal penalties attached. Well, no, it was just a condemnation, true, and it was calling on the government to conduct a study on ways to combat it. You know, and what the defenders of Motion 103 were doing is being a little bit disingenuous or precious. It's true, the motion was only a motion, but it was calling upon for the government to come up with further action. Well, that's what's happening now. But now those penalties are being bruited about, just as the foes of Motion 103 warned that they would be. The M103 backers are simply trying to criminalize a segment of opinion. In arguing that there should be censorship of talk radio in Canada, they offered this as justification. Radio Poubelle, that's trash radio stations, often air segments voicing concerns about Muslim immigration and the threat of Islamic terrorism. Oh my gosh, really? How terrible! Why shouldn't one be able to discuss those issues? Canadians are going to have to decide whether they still value the freedom of speech as an indispensable prerequisite for a free society, or whether they're going to adopt Sharia blasphemy restrictions under the guise of diversity. And other Western nations are soon going to face the same choice as well. Now, one of the problems here is, one of the problems is, as you get an increasingly large Muslim portion of the population, you will get forces for censorship among them. That's true. Not all Muslims support that censorship, but there will be a strong call for restricting free speech that criticizes Islam. Because many Muslim countries have such blasphemy laws under Sharia law. And they will try to impose that on us. And why not? Of course, you know, if they've got the numbers, they will try. Seeing that we are led by such fools and cowards who allow these type of people into our country in the first place. And this is from Anthony Fury, writing for Post Media. After the first M103 hearing on Monday, I wrote that we were perhaps facing a less adversarial process than expected. Liberal Member of Parliament Iqra Khalid was conciliatory as the initial witness, emphasizing that her motion to tackle discrimination was equally about all religions and races. She hardly mentioned the ill-defined phrase Islamophobia. How quickly things change. Wednesday's hearing confirmed some of Canadians' worst suspicions about the process and its effects on free speech. Witness, and he's one of these mixed-race people, Michel Juno Katsuya was an officer both with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, so he was both a cop and a snoop. He's been in private security for a number of years and is a regular media voice offering commentary on national security and terror. From what I know of him, and this is Anthony Fury writing, he's never said anything particularly controversial. Yet on Wednesday, he offered a number of eerie observations about using the state to deal with voices that go too far. Oh, and what would that be? Juno Katsuya used his time to speak in French, so all my quotes are the interpreter's words, about the threat of the alt-right in Quebec, never specifying how he was using the term. This in itself is no big deal, and Quebec certainly seems to have a problem with radicalism. But then he went on to chastise what he called trash radio in Quebec, recommending that they should perhaps have their licenses pulled for engaging in Islamophobia. You see, I mean, any difference between a country like that and, communist Cuba? No, of course not. You have the wrong opinion, we shut you down. What exactly are they saying on Francophone radio? Are they calling for violence, issuing death threats? In the aftermath of the Quebec mosque shooting back in January, there were similar calls to deal with these stations. A CBC story featured much hand-wringing over the stations. Well, because they're competition to the Communist Broadcasting Corporation. But could only offer this evidence. Radio Poubelle, that's trash radio stations, often air segments voicing concerns about Muslim immigration and the threat of Islamic terrorism. And why shouldn't they? Is that it? Maybe they're rude and excessive. But how is that a crime that warrants the government shutting them down? Juno Katsuya, he's the former CSIS snoop and Royal Canadian Mounted Policeman, then lamented that there was, quote, too much shyness and political correctness when it comes to the prosecuting process, letting it go under the blanket of free speech and letting things go too far. We should be prosecuting more, he said. So, more prosecutions of people criticizing Islam and Islamic terrorism and Islamic immigration. Juno Katsuya said it should be denounced and, if possible, prosecuted because here, this is defamation. I'm sorry, I missed something here. He was then asked by Liberal MP Arif Virani if rebel media, now that was run by Zionist Ezra Levant, but did and does put out some good things, particularly on immigration. This MP asked him whether rebel media amplifies the voices of the extreme right, and the former CSIS snoop said yes. Virani then read out a tweet that wrongly said the Quebec City shooter had unspecified Muslim accomplice. Juno Katsuya said it should be denounced and, if possible, prosecuted because here, this is defamation. Not sure who's being defamed, anyway. In the tweet, Virani then revealed that what was in fact made by my colleague Tarek Fatah, who was also testifying that day. Well, what should we make of all this? No one disputes that people should be charged for threats, harassment, and of course assault. But that wasn't being discussed. No, this was a former federal police officer basically toying with the censoring of the media and the prosecuting of individuals when things go too far, whatever that is. My colleagues in the media, says Anthony Fury, try to say that M103 was a toothless motion. Yet here we are having a committee hearing. Then they said it would never lead to suppression of free speech. Yet look what just happened. This is a dangerous game we're playing. Everyone's free to disagree with Quebec Talk Radio, as well as Tarek Fatah, until the cows come home. But prosecution? And this is, I think, a very, very good point, and something that we are facing increasingly. These attacks on free speech. And now we switch to the United States. Muslims demand that infidel owner remove perfect man sign. But he has a brilliant counteroffer. This comes from U.S. Conservative Religion, U.S. News. And this is the sign. I'll read it to you. The perfect man. And you can sort of check these things off. Marry a six-year-old. Beheaded 600 Jews in one day. Slave owner and dealer. 13 wives, 11 at one time. Rapist. Tortured and killed unbelievers. And he concludes, educate the truthophobes. After Muslims demanded the removal of a billboard criticizing the Islamic prophet Muhammad, owner Don Woodsmall, now this is the billboard owner, had a brilliant response. Just days ago, leftists and Muslim groups across the U.S. loudly condemned a billboard along Interstate 465 near Indianapolis in Indiana. The sign contains a simple message, the prophet, the perfect man. And that's suggesting Muhammad. But this is obviously tongue-in-cheek. With checkmarked bullet points, including rapist, 13 wives, 11 at one time, tortured and killed unbelievers. Instantly, Muslims knew that the billboard was calling out their prophet. When Muslims noticed the billboard calling their prophet Muhammad a rapist who married a six-year-old, they immediately demanded the removal of the racist and Islamophobic message. However, the uproar forced the billboard owner to come forward, and he has just one thing to say to them. Although Islam was never mentioned, instantly Muslims knew the billboard was calling out their prophet Muhammad. Prompting them to demand the sign's removal in accordance with Sharia blasphemy laws. This national outcry has already prompted the sign's owner to relinquish his personal safety by coming forward to not only take credit for the billboard's construction, but to issue yet another daring message to truthophobes who denies credibility. WTHR reports that Don Woodsmall, who is a Duke Law School graduate, has proudly taken responsibility for the billboard. And sorry, I have just lost the thing here. He's proudly taken a responsibility for the billboard. And this is a little bit annoying. And he has he's challenging okay, we're gonna get this back here in a sec. Anyway, he is challenging the critics to prove how it's wrong. And I think that's an important thing. Prove how it's wrong. Don't just call for it to be censored or shut down. Prove that it is wrong. And this is, of course, what the enemies of free speech, hate to do. Of course, it's far easier just to end the discussion with, you shut up. And that's all too often what is being done. And of course, that's the easy approach of professional censors. Shut up. Here we are. Okay. WTHR reports that Don Woodsmall, who's a Duke Law School graduate, has proudly taken responsibility for the billboard, but says that while he's unafraid to show his face to the dangerous Muslim community, he'll protect his clients' identities. So Woodsmall came forward to local media to slam free speech objectors, confidently declaring that he would gladly remove the sign himself. All they have to do is prove that the statement is wrong. In other words, is this a defamation of Muhammad? Did he in fact not own slaves? Did he in fact not marry a six-year-old? Did he not in fact over his life have 13 wives, 11 of them at one time? Now, if those are points are false, then yes, the sign should be taken down. In his statement, Woodsmall says, "It's interesting to note the Muslim community knew exactly who it was referring to. The truth is a powerful weapon." Woodsmall explained that he only agreed to erect the sign after thoroughly researching each claim and finding proof directly in the passages in the Quran and Hadith. In addition, he spoke to at least a half a dozen Islamic scholars who confirmed the scriptures in question. Quote, "I was convinced that each point listed on the billboard was historically and factually true. I would encourage others to do their own research to verify the veracity of each and every point." Woodsmall also said, and he noted that he would remove the billboards if the statements were proven to be false. Despite Muslims demanding that Woodsmall name his clients, undoubtedly for nefarious purposes, the billboard owner refuses to endanger their lives. The unwavering owner slammed the science critics, reminding them that it is the very definition of free speech to question and tear apart lies and toxic ideologies. And I do find it interesting that that there is the fear that Woodsmall didn't erect the sign. It's not his sign. He's not paying for it. He simply owns the billboard. But there seem to be real reasons for the people who did commission it to fear for their lives. "My clients want this national conversation to happen if we are to overcome the violence that plagues Islam. This is not only pro-American, but beneficial to Muslims who came to America to escape Sharia. Disturbingly, designated terrorist group CAIR and lying Muslims are declaring the message racist and Islamophobic, although none can provide any scripture or historical text to back up their points. On the other hand, each one of the bullet points has a direct correlation to the Quran and Hadith." You can see this on our website, and that's cafe.nfshost.com, CAFE, Canadian Association for Free Expression, cafe.nfshost.com, and with the citations from the Quran, I won't read them because I think they're pretty obscure. If the Muslim critics were honest, they point out that that the only flaw in Woodsmall's message is that Muhammad didn't necessarily behead 600 Jews in one day. Historical records suggest the number is between 500 and 900 Jews, and likely over a period of several days. Okay, the difference is, shall we say, slight. If the left considers it hate speech to summarize these violent and bigoted Islamic passages, it's time for them to admit that the Quran and Hadith are hate speech. It's not racist to denounce Muhammad's ownership of dozens of black slaves as racist. In fact, it's racist to Muslims and leftists to defend Muhammad's slave ownership and attempt to censor it. Basically, I don't think at least the left actually defends it. They just they don't want you mustn't say that. Well, why? Well, because Muslims are a favorite group, and we mustn't criticize them. The truth is that the Prophet Muhammad boasted of his own racist racist slave ownership, sex slavery, marriage to a child, and mass slaughter of unbelieving men, women, and children. These are not fear-mongering allegations, but direct quotations from the Prophet, his closest companions, and even his favorite child bride, Aisha. It's inexcusable for Muslims to demand that we shut up or apologize for pointing out the sadistic behavior of their Prophet. Instead, they are the ones who should be apologizing for calling a slave-owning, murdering, pedophile rapist the perfect man, and denounce his actions immediately. Yes, and what I like about this is it's taking the war back to them, saying, you've got some explaining to do. And no, we don't have explaining to do when we point out that there are very, very questionable things about your religion. Well, Toronto Life, it's a magazine, as you might imagine, about Toronto, and it has a feature article in the most recent issue, which I find quite fascinating, and you probably will too. It's all about a fellow named Johnson Chrome. Yeah. I suspect without going any further, you will know that he was not born in County Tipperary. What type of a person, that's not his given name at birth, but what type of a person gives himself a name, Johnson Chrome? Well, he's a Negro from Nigeria, a notorious con man, big spender, high liver, and quite a blight on the Canadian immigration system. He has probably conned Torontonians out of millions of dollars. Here's just some of what he has. He owns 90 pairs of shoes, a collection worth $100,000. One pair was made of crocodile hide and cost $10,000. Another was encrusted with hundreds of tiny silver spikes. He wore watches so gargantuan that they seemed to drag on his arm. One of them, the $150,000 Romain Jerome Moondust, actually contained moon dust. His dress shirts cost $700, his sunglasses $800 apiece. His personal scent, Clive Christian number one, bills itself as the world's most expensive perfume at about $1,500 a bottle. He and some mostly Negro pals would regularly dine in a very tony area of Toronto Yorkville. I won't read that. And according to Toronto Life, where they'd spend hundreds, sometimes thousands, on bottle service, drinking and carousing until they closed. Anyway, he also had a condominium in a very pricey area of Yorkville. He also had he put a deposit on a $3.5 million mansion up near Kleinburg, north of Toronto. He had another condo where he parked his wife and three children in the north end of Toronto. Anyway, you might wonder, well, how did he come by such wealth? Well, not by honest work, by elaborate theft of people's credit cards and personal data. So he parlayed identity theft into a multi-million-dollar business. He would break in or have people break into mailboxes, especially in condos or apartments, try to steal people's personal information, particularly credit card statements and so on. And he would begin to put together a profile. In fact, he had hundreds and hundreds of these profiles. And one of many approaches would be to call up the credit card company and say, I've lost my Visa. And then they would ask a few questions like, what's your date of birth? What the number was on the Visa? Your home address, blah, blah, blah. You answer those questions correctly, and they will then send you another one. Now, he positioned himself to intercept that mail when it came in. Here he has a new credit card, and he basically could max it out. That was one of the schemes. This is what I find particularly, that's who he was. So a shameless, scheming individual who engaged in identity theft. Now, Johnson Chrome was born Adekunle Johnson Omitiran in 1980 in the slums of Lagos, Nigeria. His father, Gabadibo, was a traveling businessman from southwestern Nigeria. When Chrome was a boy, Gabadibo left Chrome's mother, a Fulani woman from the north, and at one point allegedly had as many as six wives. Gabadibo studied at the University of Exeter in England and later found his way to Toronto. Chrome's mother was left to raise him and his brother. Chrome apparently spent a lot of time on the streets in Lagos. He attended Lagos State University, and in 2003, when he was 23, his father brought him to Toronto. And here, of course, we have how he got in. Chrome enrolled at York University, but within a year, he entered the world of fraud. Apparently, never graduated from university. In 2004, one year after he comes to Canada, Canada Customs intercepted a suspicious parcel destined for Chrome's apartment. The package had come from Nigeria, and it was heavy enough to qualify for inspection. Inside, officials discovered 36 envelopes addressed to various people in the U.S., each containing a counterfeit check for roughly $10,000. The intended recipients had placed ads online selling various items. Fraudsters posing as brokers wrote letters explaining they wanted to buy the item, but the buyers had already written a check for more than the asking price. Would the recipient be so kind as to deposit it and wire back the difference? In most instances of the scam, the intended target is skeptical and ignores the letter. But enough people would, of course, deposit the check, and it would take a while because it's an overseas check to clear. And if they forwarded the required difference, which might be $1,000 or $2,000, well, you see the way it works. But, and this is a well-known scam. Now, the police claim that Chrome's job was to mail the letters from Canada, bypassing the suspicions of U.S. postal officials. Toronto police set up a fake FedEx delivery to Chrome's address. They arrested him, but charges were withdrawn. Subsequently, on a different matter, he pleaded guilty to fraud under $5,000 and received a 12-month conditional discharge, which effectively wiped his record clean after the sentence was over. By 2007, in the shortest time possible, he'd obtained Canadian citizenship. So now he's ours. Now, you know, he already defrauded the banks out of an amount, amount less than $5,000. But what happened to him? Well, basically nothing. A conditional sentence. So as long as he behaved himself for a year, he'd be okay. So when the courts don't take fraud seriously, it just emboldens the fraudsters. Next came a spending spree. Often, Crone would withdraw cash at an ATM or purchase prepaid gift cards. Crone's scam was labor-intensive, hustling for a few $1,000s at a time. But therein it lay its brilliance. Banks, though they won't admit it, tend not to waste their time chasing small sums, which they can quickly reverse. It's painstaking work for the police to chase down each reported fraud. Crown prosecutors roll their eyes at the complicated paperwork, and judges are often loath to dish out heavy penalties, since the crime is nonviolent, and the ultimate victim is almost always the banks, which can write off the losses. So basically, it's a problem of the failure of the system to take these things seriously. Crone's girlfriend from Nigeria, Olu Bukola Bucky, that's her nickname, Jagetti, followed him to Canada. They married and eventually had three kids. Now, very interesting. Well, how did she follow him to Canada? What sort of background would she have that would suggest she might be a great Canadian citizen? Well, none at all. So the story of this very successful con man is an immigration failure and a failure of the justice system. Police eventually found enough evidence from ATM security footage to lay 53 charges. Crone pleaded guilty to a handful of charges in exchange for getting the others withdrawn, and he got off with two concurrent sentences of 6 months house arrest, again avoiding significant jail time. And so began a game of cat and mouse with the police. Once again, a failure of the justice system. And like any successful businessman, the Toronto Life story says, Crone learned to delegate. Police say he teamed up with a fellow Nigerian, Mickey Noah, who would allegedly make ATM withdrawals and request new cards and PIN changes as part of Crone's operation. Well, once again, we don't have that much information about Mickey Noah, but from Nigeria, how did he get in? Well, another great immigration success story. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Going to take a short musical interlude, and I'm going to play a song that I think you'll really like. And this is called Mr. Confederate Man by Rebel Sun. Mr. Confederate Man by Rebel Sun. Hope you enjoy it. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me.
I was just a little boy in elementary school. English and math and science class, learning the golden rule. I learned how to add and how to subtract, how to multiply and divide. I learned about bugs and I learned about plants and I learned how to read and write. But my most favorite class of all was my last class of the day, when my history teacher would tell us tales of old times long gone away. I was amazed at the way she knew all the people and their names and the places and the dates. That's when I first learned about General Lee and his 13 rebel states. One day she came to school with a big brown grocery bag. She opened it up, we all helped her hold up this great big egg-shaped flag. She said, "Class, now only a fool will tell you this flag is a symbol of hate. It represents the men who fought and died with pride for our Confederate states. Your assignment tonight, I want you to write, I want you to pretend that one of these brave men came back to life. Now what would you say to him?" Well, the school bell rang and I thought, as the bus carried me across town, I got out my pencil and my notebook pad, and this is what I wrote down. I wrote, "Mr. Confederate man, I'd like to shake your hand for giving your life for Dixieland. Mr. Confederate man." The next day in history class, I put my paper on the teacher's desk. Then she called me up in front of everyone because she said she liked mine the best. I walked up to the head of the class. My teacher smiled and she nodded at me. Then I saw a tear roll down her cheek as I began to read. I read, "Mr. Confederate man, I'd like to shake your hand for giving your life for Dixieland. Mr. Confederate man." Well, I was at home reading through the news just the other day, when I ran across my old teacher's name and I saw where she had passed away. With a bittersweet smile, I looked up at my wall, a wrinkled paper in an old wood frame, where underneath pencil words almost faded away, she had marked a great big red A. Plus, "Mr. Confederate man, I'd like to shake your hand for giving your life for Dixieland. Mr. Confederate man." I wrote, "Mr. Confederate man, I'd like to shake your hand for giving your life for Dixieland. Mr. Confederate man."
Mr. Confederate Man, and that's Rebel Sun. And if you want another song by him, this is called "Bury Me in Southern Ground" by Rebel Sun, with a big old Confederate flag.
Granddaddy and my daddy's ways. They both taught me right from wrong, how to fight and how to get along. But my own life now is almost gone. In southern ground I belong. My final hour is right here. Let's laugh and talk about our lives and the good old days before I die. Please give your word this vow you'll keep. When I return to earth to sleep, let me dream forever under southern land with a Dixie flag tied in my hand. Just this one last request. Dixieland is where I want to make my final stand. I don't care if I'm in a box or not when they lay me down. Just bury me in southern ground. Look at the countryside before I close my weary eyes. Southern air for my last breath. Here comes my sweet angel of death. Sing Dixie while they lower me, so I'll hear it for eternity. I can feel the reaper's touch, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Friend, when my time has come, before they lay me down to rest, friend, in my time of darkness, please grant me just this one last request. Dixieland is where I want to make my final stand. I don't care if I'm in a box or not when they lay me down. Just bury me in southern ground.
Up on a slightly lighter note, this is a song by Leona Williams. She was once Mrs. Merle Haggard, remained good friends to the end of life. And this is Merle, this is Leona. Yes, ma'am, he found me in a honky tonk. This is Paul Fromm, and you found me on lightresistanceradio.com.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. where good girls shouldn't go. Yes, I know he deserves the best, and there's better girls than me. Please don't quarrel with me, 'cause I love him, can't you see? Yes, ma'am, I partied with a crazy crowd, but someone just like your loving son helped to show me how. Yes, someone just like your loving son helped to show me how.
And that's Leona Williams. Yes, ma'am. He found me in a honky-tonk. Gonna end up tonight with this is, of course, an extended joke. Okay, so but it comes from England. I think it's kind of cute and kind of makes a point, I think. It makes a lot of sense. Apparently the suicide bombers are going to go on strike. believe it or not, yes, suicide bombers are about to go on strike. In Muslim suicide bombers in Britain are set to begin a 3-week strike on next week in a dispute over the number of virgins they are entitled to in the afterlife. Emergency talks with Al-Qaeda have so far failed to produce an agreement. The unrest began this past Tuesday when Al-Qaeda announced that the number of virgins a suicide bomber would receive after his death would be cut by 25% this February from 72 to 54. A spokesman said increases in recent years in the numbers suicide bombings has resulted in a shortage of virgins in the afterlife. The Suicide Bombers Union, the British Organization of Occupational Martyrs, or BOOM, responded with a statement saying the move was unacceptable to its members and called for a strike vote. General Secretary Abdullah Alaud Bang told the press, quote, "Our members are literally working themselves to death in the cause of jihad. We don't ask for much in return, but to be treated like this is like a kick in the tooth." Speaking of from his shed in Tipton in the West Midlands, Al-Qaeda chief executive Ashit Mappatz explained, "I sympathize with our workers' concerns, but Al-Qaeda is simply not in a position to meet their demands. They are simply not accepting the realities of modern-day jihad in a competitive marketplace. Thanks to Western depravity, there's now a chronic shortage of virgins in the afterlife. It's a straight choice between reducing expenditures or laying people off. I don't like cutting benefits, but I'd hate to tell 3,000 of my staff that they won't be able to blow themselves up." spokesman for the union in the northeast of England, Ireland, Wales, and the entire Australian continent stated that the change would not hurt their memberships, as there are so few virgins in their areas anyway. According to some industry sources, the recent drop in the number of suicide bombings has been attributed to Rosie O'Donnell. Many Muslim jihadists now know what a virgin looks like and have reconsidered their benefit packages. Okay, well, now, yeah, this is a tongue-in-cheek and being a little silly, but end off tonight on this note, and it's I'd say it's a healthy note. How Bangladesh defends its borders. See, it's got all these Rohingya Muslims pouring in from Burma. They say they're being persecuted. There's a guerrilla warfare. The Burmese government has attacked some of the Rohingya villages, etc. Anyway, you've got to remember Bangladesh is Muslim, okay? Bangladesh border guards are burning boats that bring Rohingya in a bid to crack down on the refugee flow. Bangladeshi border guards are setting fire to boats used to carry Rohingya refugees in an effort to stop the influx of people fleeing from Burma, according to human rights groups. Boat owners in southeast Bangladesh have made significant profits by picking up refugees and ferrying them across the border to safety. But Bangladeshi security forces are now trying to deter the practice by torching the boats. Well, among other things, it's a kind of illegal entry into the country, right? And maybe this is the pathetic thing. The Bangladeshi authorities are taking protection of their border a lot more seriously than the Canadian authorities are. We're being invaded across the American border through Quebec by hordes of Haitians. From the beach at Shapuri, on the border with Burma, also known as Myanmar, this is the Daily Telegraph, British paper, saw several fires burning and later saw the charred remains of wooden hulls strewn across the beach, along the beach rather. Local people told me boatmen caught dropping Rohingya people here are having their boats burned as a punishment and warning. It's deemed necessary as border control, said Ashikar Rahman from the Odhikar, a Bangladeshi human rights group. It makes sense, doesn't it? Every nation seems, except some Western nations, seem able to defend their borders, and it makes sense. You can't have people storming across the borders illegally. And I guess it makes sense everywhere, but in the in a West so often led by traitors who basically want us to be replaced. Well, this is Paul Frommer. You have to remember, of course, that the Rohingyas are basically our former Bengalis, and they're Muslims. So it's not like they're radically different people. Well, this is Paul Frommer. You're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern Time. The show is repeated in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time, and I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever, played by the 48th Highlanders of Canada.